Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Albert Coates, a founder of the Institute of Government, now called the School of Government, is certainly one of North Carolina's real true heroes. But he was demanding and impatient with people who didn't see things his way. He was a complicated and wonderful character, as we are learning more about him from a brand new book called The Good Government Man, Albert Coates and the Early Years of the Institute of Government by Howard Covington. And Howard Covington's our guest and is going to tell us more about this complicated and incredibly effective North Carolina hero. Howard Covington, welcome. When did you start learning that Albert Coates wasn't the perfect hero in the pantheon of North Carolina heroes?
Well, a real telling piece of evidence was the thickness of his personnel file.
What do you mean? You mean his he was a law school faculty member and an employee of the university as,
right,
as a head of the Institute of Government. And so he had a big, thick personnel file. What do you mean? With lots of letters of congratulations? And
No, not always. Albert Coates was, I guess, as bullheaded and opinionated a person, and the two of them together, it was certain to lead him into difficulty over the years with those, certainly with those with whom he didn't disagree or who disagreed with him. And those qualities, one, probably led to the success of the Institute of Government, but it also led to considerable trouble with his bosses over the years, who didn't really see the Coatesian view of the world or adopt it as wholeheartedly as Albert did.
For those of us who might not know the origins of the Institute of Government, now the School of Government, can you give us, you know, we think of it as the institution that has been here forever, mm-hmm, and that has been responsible for the professionalism of North Carolina's local government class, that it is one of the finest examples of the outreach of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, to the whole state. It's sort of on a shining hill of the kinds of things that a public university ought to be about. But it wasn't part of any university long-range plan, was it? How did it get started?
Not at all. And actually, I'm glad you raised that as you did, because I want to make sure we mention a name here. Edward Kidder Graham was the uncle of Frank Porter Graham, who is the Graham that most everyone thinks of in connection with the University of North Carolina. Edward Kidder Graham was became president his first year when Albert Coates came to Chapel Hill from Johnston County, Smithfield, where he was raised, and was president throughout Coates's time at the university, and had a profound effect on Albert Coates. It was Edward Kidder Graham who really promoted the idea and developed the philosophy and vision of the university that it should serve the entire state. Up to that time, the university was considered sort of a school for the elites, the wealthy money class in North Carolina. Graham set out to change that. And with Robert House, another devotee of Graham's, they really began to put in place programs that took the university into every county and almost every school. One of the things they did in those days, and I'm talking about 1914, 1918, was create debate societies in local high schools. And at the end of the year, the winners in the local communities would come to a concluding competition at the university. Local libraries, a hometown library, could draw books from the university library. These are the kinds of things that Graham and House really promoted, and Albert Coates was sitting right at, not literally, but very close to Graham throughout this whole period, and he took the notion of the university as a servant of the people of North Carolina, and within 10 or 12 years had developed what he called his begriff.
Let me interrupt you just real quickly, because just to put it in focus, Albert Coates was one of these country boys from Johnson County,
yeah,
and came came to the University of North Carolina at the time before the beginning of the First World War, and among his classmates during the time that he was there, or among the people who were here, he intersected with people like Frank Graham, mm-hmm, Thomas Wolfe, mm-hmm, Paul Green, mm-hmm, and others, Sam Ervin as students. This was a, you know, looking back at it, this was kind of a dream time, and it was the campus was small enough where everybody sort of knew each other.
1,500 students, yeah.
Yeah. So
and
anyway,
it got even smaller during the war years because everybody left for military service.
Yeah, and it was a time when, golly, I mean, I get excited. You can tell I get excited talking about this, just dreaming about this important time. But Edward Kidder Graham is quoted as saying that he wanted the boundaries of the university to be coterminous with the boundaries of the state. Everybody quotes him, but nobody can. I didn't find that you quoted him, but nobody can find the site where he really said this. But that it captures the spirit that you're describing of his administration.
And Coates served as Graham's secretary one summer. Well, actually, 2 years he worked for Graham, just became totally enthralled by this man who inspired him and many, many others. But I mean, had a deeply profound effect on Albert Coates, and Coates, a light went out for part of the world when Graham died in the flu epidemic of 1918. That was a devastating time for Albert, as it was for many others. But I think those years with Graham inspired him to, when he came back to the university as a law professor in 1923, he began thinking about how can the university serve the people of North Carolina. And it was out of this that he, in sort of a twist and some twists and turns, came up with this idea of the law school serving as a platform from which to help train public officials to do their job better. This was a time of great interest in reform in local municipal government. County government was a big mess at that time, because the county commissioners would, in some counties, would sit around the stove and decide things just sort of on an ad hoc basis. That was documented by another bright light at the university at that time, Howard Odom, who had started the Institute for Research in Social Science. So there was a time of great excitement about how the university could serve the state and the things that could happen to make life better.
Now, Mr. Coates had come back from a study at Harvard University in law school to go directly onto the law school faculty.
Very unusual.
Pretty unusual, at least for those times. Had no experience in practicing law. And then did he undertake this interest in going outside the usual mission of the law school to educate public officials? Did that have the was he following directions from the dean of the law school?
No, absolutely not. just the opposite. His work actually first began with law students, trying to help law students become better prepared to become day-to-day practitioners. And then he got a fellowship and went back to Harvard for a year. And while he was there, he came up with this plan that eventually led to the organization of what he called the Institute of Government. And he began initially the law school gave it a tacit endorsement. You could tell Albert, you could give Albert Coates a nod, and he would take it as standing applause. He knew he was on to something, and he knew that there was value in it. Most importantly for Albert, though, he knew that Frank Graham, who became president of the university in the early 30s, would support him. And Graham, being a very generous but also something of a visionary, held off those who couldn't deal with Coates's little idiosyncrasies.
Let's take a quick break and come back and talk about those idiosyncrasies,
okay,
and how the other people in the university attempted to deal with Mr. Coates and his ambitious programs. Howard Covington is the author of a brand new book called The Good Government Man, Albert Coates in the Early Years of the Institute of Government. He and I'll be right back.
Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Howard Covington is the author of a brand new book about an important Chapel Hill icon, Albert Coates. The book is called The Good Government Man, Albert Coates in the Early Years of the Institute of Government. And Howard Covington has popped the balloon that I had of Albert Coates as being a perfect person and described how some of his imperfections made it possible for him to be so successful. And we're talking about the origins, Howard, of the idea of the Institute of Government, how it got started as Albert Coates was a mere young professor in the law school. And I interrupted you as you were beginning to talk about how some of Coates's plans and activities got in the way of him getting along with his superiors and colleagues in the university. So keep going.
Well, Albert Coates, on paper, was a professor of law in the school, in the University School of Law. His job was to show up at class and teach the law to students in the law school. His specialty, which he took great pride in teaching, was criminal law. He also taught courses in domestic law and the legislative process. But most law students who came through the law school had him as their criminal law professor. So he was supposed to be a law professor. The dean at the school at that time was M.H. Van Hecke, and the dean the school was undergoing budget cuts as the state reduced its funding to the university, and he was finding it harder and harder to make ends
this
meet, and he couldn't spare to have Albert Coates out there doing other things.
This is Depression time?
Depression years, yeah.
So much even worse than the times that the university is going to have to face in the upcoming years.
But Albert wouldn't show up for class. He would be out tub thumping raising money for to get his Institute of Government going, or making speeches. And this just drove the dean to distraction. He, at one point, he said, you know, if Albert Coates were a student, we would have kicked him out because he just didn't show up for work.
Now, this is some of the things that might be going in that thick personnel file that you said was your clue that Albert might have not been a perfect angel.
Van Hecke wasn't opposed to the Institute of Government, but he was very practical-minded and said, you know, if you want an Institute of Government, Albert Coates is your man. Mr. President, Frank Graham, go set that up for him and let him run it. Meanwhile, I need a law professor.
Well, what Howard? What was the at this point in time? What was the Institute of Government? Was it a part of the university? Was it a school? A center? what legal status did it have?
It had absolutely no legal status. It was run out of Albert's hip pocket, and well, with the help of his wife Gladys. We want to talk about Gladys.
Yeah, but, absolutely. But just hard to imagine in today's time. This was, what was going on with the Institute of Government out of Albert Coates' back pocket?
In Albert Coates' mind, there were a lot of things going on. I mean, he had an organization of associations that included every conceivable kind of public official. And these associations would meet in local district meetings, and then they would come together once a year in Chapel Hill for a big annual meeting. And he did draw several hundred of public officials to Chapel Hill for these meetings, they generated a lot of attention and publicity for the university. Really nothing was going on. There was more flash and bang than there was substance to it. Albert kept saying that they were going to produce a lot of reports, and these they would generate reforms out of the studies and work that the association of the public officials would help them do their jobs better. Really, for several years, even though there, I'll say several years, the first three or four years, nothing really happened except these annual meetings. Then Albert was able to get some money from the Cones, the Cone brothers.
Herman. Over in Greensboro.
Right. Ben Cone and Caesar Cone gave Albert enough money for him to hire a small staff. And they began doing.
Let me just
work.
Interrupt you, because this is something that startled me as I read your book, and I'm not sure I understand completely. When the Cones gave the money, did they just write a check to Albert? Did they just write a check to the university
for the benefit
of Albert? What? How did
Again,
that work?
There's no connection whatsoever with the university. Albert tried mightily to get support from the Rockefeller Foundation. He was very envious of Howard Odum. Who did a very good job of milking foundations for projects that Howard Odum wanted to do, and that just drove Albert crazy. He believed that if he liked a project, then he should be able to go to a foundation and they would write him a check. Well, foundations didn't work that way. They wanted something more substantial than just Albert's promises, and he never could get any foundation money. His only success was with individuals, and the Cones were the most generous.
What was Albert Coates' secret of success in this fundraising? Was he just a born salesman, a flim-flam man, or was he just so persistent that people wanted to kick him out the door, get him out of the way?
It helped that he had the backing of the Cones. Ben Cone was a classmate, had been at school with him, so he knew Ben Cone from his undergraduate days. But he would basically wear people down. Albert was the last of the great orators out of the university. He could stand on a platform and hold an audience for 30 or 40 minutes or longer. There's some anecdotes, you know, people say, well, some of these folks wrote Albert a check just to get him out of their office. He would be so persistent. But the Cones really believed in what Albert was doing and what he was about, and gave him enough money to hire staff and really begin. I guess the biggest stroke in his favor was when he started producing reports on the daily business of the General Assembly.
How did that get going? Can you remember the years?
The first session. Well, he tried something in 1935 to send out a summary report of what happened in the legislature, but that was just more than was humanly possible with the staff he had. Excuse me. It took him so long to get it out. In 1937, he was back, and they were doing daily reports. And this was the first time anything like this had ever happened. The legislature had absolutely no staff. These amateur legislators had come to town and didn't know from one day to the next what was happening. And all of a sudden, Albert and the Institute of Government's producing this report that lands on their desk that tells them about all the bills that were introduced the day before and what happened to them. It didn't try to log the debate, of course, but just was a tracking method. And the first time that, and these were sent out to local, into the courthouses and city hall offices around the state. So
it's hard for us to imagine in today's time of instant communication and internet and web pages and all of this, where we can listen in and see the work of the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
That 80 years ago, you just had to wait until the law was passed and you got caught violating it. The action of the legislature, particularly in the preliminary phases, was just not covered.
Right.
The other thing that was interesting to me that as you described it, and it reminded me of something so important just in getting things done, was that although that Institute of Government legislative reports became sort of one of the flagship services of the Institute of Government, mm-hmm. that everybody depended on, that when it got started, they had to push their way into the inside of the legislature where they could even get copies of the bills and the legislative documents.
Right, they sat in the gallery with the rest of the visitors and didn't have access to the daily flow of paper. In fact, the folks in the clerk's offices in the respective chambers treated them rather suspiciously as intruders, and it wasn't until it turned out that these young lawyers that Albert Coates had hired to track the legislature had a better tracking system than the clerks did. And the clerks would come to them and ask for advice
and turn around
about where a bill was or what had happened to it. And eventually, the Institute folks were invited to sit down on the floor near the clerk's office. Which when the first day that Albert realized that was happening, he raised hell about it. He didn't want any favors from the legislators. He valued the Institute's independence.
We're visiting with Howard Covington, who's the author of a new book, The Good Government Man, Albert Coates and the Early Years of the Institute of Government. And we're finding out that Albert Coates, one of Chapel Hill's icons, is a very, very interesting person. Howard Covington and I will be right back.
Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. Howard Covington and I are talking about Albert Coates, and we're doing it in the context of Howard Covington's brand new book, The Good Government Man, Albert Coates and the Early Years of the Institute of Government. And we're doing it in the context of a celebration of this book. One of the things that you're going to be doing, Howard Covington, will be on November the 8th at the School of Government building from 5 o'clock to 6:45. You will be there to talk about some more about this is described as the colorful, energetic professor of law who founded one of the university's most admired and influential public service programs. So come at register at 5 o'clock, and there'll be, I guess, some little bit of a reception, and then your program at 5:45, all that on November 8th at the School of Government. I'm looking forward to that, Howard. You'll be at a newly renovated Institute of Government building. When we've been talking about Coates in the early years in the 1930s with his Institute of Government that wasn't even a strictly speaking, an official part of the university, but he was working, where did all this work get done?
Well, he found space wherever he could find it, wherever Frank Graham would free up something for him on campus. He moved around in the attic of the law school and then in some other buildings a vacant fraternity house at one time, and in the mid 30s he had ambitions to build a building. I mean, this was a guy who wanted monuments. He wanted something substantial there so people could say, see, the Institute of Government is real and it does exist. And he actually got a grant, a WPA grant, to build a building.
This was a Franklin Roosevelt Depression era stimulus program that provided grants for construction-ready projects.
Right. And Albert said if the government would provide the money for labor, that the materials would be donated by supporters from all across the state. Well, he always had more plan than he had really substance to his plan, and he got this grant, and he never could get together the material donations. In fact, he kept having to get this thing postponed and postponed and postponed. At one point, Josiah Bailey, our United States Senator, even literally went to Franklin Roosevelt and said, "Would you give us a 30-day extension?" And Roosevelt granted it. Of course, Albert didn't make it. That made the deadline. That fell through. In the late 30s, however, he bought a piece of land on Franklin Street, which is sort of almost directly across from where Graham Memorial is now, and that's the E.K. Graham Memorial.
I want to interrupt you just to emphasize that when you said he bought a piece of land, it wasn't the university bought a piece
no,
of land.
No, Albert bought it. This was not university property. It was private property.
And it wasn't the Institute of Government.
On the north side of Franklin Street.
It wasn't the Institute of Government buying it because there was no such thing at that
point.
There
was no such thing. Albert refused to. He wasn't incorporated. He didn't have it. And that was one of the frustrating things to Frank Graham. Frank Graham said, I can bring you into the university, but you've got to have some organization. You've got to have some formal organization here that we can recognize. And Albert never would incorporate the Institute of Government.
So he bought a piece of land on Franklin Street.
He and his wife Gladys bought this piece of land. And he succeeded in raising enough money, about $100,000, to open the Institute of Government building on Franklin Street in 1939.
So he built a building,
yes,
which he called the Institute of Government building,
yes,
but was really owned by him and mortgaged in his name. I mean, there was a debt on this building.
He was up to his ears in debt. He was always in debt. He had been in debt since he was in law school.
This building, by the way, is on the cover of your book, and it is also still a very attractive building. Doesn't house the School of Government anymore, of course, or the Institute of Government, but it has a history. It was where School of Social Work was, and the international programs of the university have been housed there. So it's been.
And one time the university administration was in there.
That
in
general administration, yeah, was there. The overall university administration
right.
was there. So it's has had a distinguished history, including the part of the history when it was a university, alleged university building built by an individual, owned by him, and jealously guarded by him, I guess.
And, of course, the war came on, Depression. The Albert and Gladys' situation was so dire that at one point they discontinued phone service to their little rental house that they had on Rosemary Street.
What did Gladys Coates say to her friends when they called her to tell her that her phone had been discontinued?
Yeah, a friend of hers bumped into her on Franklin Street one day and said, "Oh, I've been trying to reach you, but they tell me your phone is no longer in working order," and she was so embarrassed and didn't want to say that they couldn't afford to pay the phone bill. So she told her friend that she and Albert had been traveling so much that they just had it discontinued for the time being.
Now,
he owed money to everybody. The Carolina Coffee Shop. Now think of this: in 1939, 1940, you could buy a full meal at the Carolina Coffee Shop for 35 cents. Albert's tab at the Carolina Coffee Shop was over $200.
Well, I mean, this is amazing. This this building, again, that we can see on Franklin Street, sort of across from the parking lot of the Moorhead or from the Graham Memorial, is a fine building. And Albert had built this building for his program. In the meantime, he and his wife were living and behind probably in their rent payments in mm-hmm. a little tiny, tiny cottage on Rosemary Street.
Right.
And in debt and strapped financially.
Right.
And about to lose his job. The law school dean, I guess, is still trying to get him dismissed.
Well, he and Van Hecke finally came to terms with another. Van Hecke realized he wasn't going to be able to get rid of Albert. Certainly not as long as Frank Graham was president. And he sort of suffered through it and said, "Okay, Albert, you're going to be on the law. You're going to be part of the law school, and we hope you're going to show up for class every once in a while. And I'm not going to fight you anymore."
What did you find from Albert Coates' law students as to how they graded him as a teacher?
When he was on, he was on. He was excellent. He was a great teacher. The problem was he didn't show up all the time and would often send somebody from the Institute of Government as he got staff and had people to do that to take his place in class. He would prod his students to search further, taking a very simple little case of criminal law like breaking and entering, and ask them, "Well, what is breaking? And if you put your foot over the threshold but don't actually step inside, have you entered?" That kind of detail that he would press his students to consider. I think if he had devoted himself to being a law professor and didn't have the Institute of Government, he would have been an outstanding law professor.
We're talking about Albert Coates. We're talking with Howard Covington, Albert Coates' biographer and the author of a brand new book, The Good Government Man, Albert Coates and the Early Years of the Institute of Government. Howard Covington and I will be right back.
Who's Talking is brought to you by University Square, a collection of locally owned high-end shops and restaurants offering unique products and free storefront parking. Visit University Square on Franklin Street, downtown Chapel Hill. University Square. See you there.
Now, here's D.G. Martin on WCHL.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about Chapel Hill icon, North Carolina icon, Albert Coates, the founder of the Institute of Government, now the School of Government, talking with Howard Covington, Mr. Coates' biographer. The new book is The Good Government Man, Albert Coates and the Early Years of the Institute of Government. All that will be the subject of a program at the School of Government on November 8th from 5 to 6:45. And Howard Covington, you'll be our guest. Now, we've talked about the early years of Albert Coates. We're not going to finish this story. People have to read your book or come to your program or do both. But of the things we haven't covered, bring us closer to the present time in terms of the success of Albert Coates and the impact of his work on North Carolina.
We've got to bring him into the university finally.
How did lasso this guy and tie him up and make him a part of the university?
Billy Carmichael did it. Billy Carmichael was the controller of the university, and I think he realized that the Institute was in such desperate straits that that Albert would be appealing to the university, to the state of North Carolina, for some sort of financial aid. And frankly, Albert Coates, through his work at the legislative service, probably had more friends in the legislature than the university did. And Carmichael realized that this was really a service that ought to be part of the university. And with his help, they finally brought it into the university just at the beginning of World War II.
Someday we'll talk about Billy Carmichael, but yeah. Basically he a loyal guy who grew up in Chapel Hill, but made his way on the outside as a very successful in business and finance. He had credibility because he could bring money to the university. Mm-hmm. He also had a business sense of how to manage in a way maybe outside the regular normal bureaucracy of the university. And he was able, because of those assets, to bring to persuade Albert Coates that he could get what he wanted in the way of financial support and blessing from the university without having to give up totally his independence. Somehow or another, Billy Carmichael made Albert Coates work in the university
environment. He did, and he was able to give him the independence that he wanted, that Albert had been holding out for over a dozen years, and it worked. And after the war, it wasn't really until 1947, 48, that the Institute began to do what Albert Coates had wanted it to do nearly two decades earlier, and that was become a serious center for training of local officials. And when I say local officials, I don't just mean city council members, but I mean he was holding sessions for the men, and most of them were men who were in charge of the water and sewer system, who paved the highways. The Institute became the principal training station for the Highway Patrol. Terry Sanford was a law student and went to work for Albert, and he ran the first Highway Patrol school at not the first one, but one of the early ones at the university, at the Institute of Government. Albert went out, set about hiring a remarkable cadre of law graduates, some of whom made their mark in the second half of the 20th century in outstanding ways. Bill Friday, the university president, worked at the Institute one summer in the Boys State program. Charles Johnson was administrative aide to Governor Luther Hodges. There were countless numbers of city attorneys and county attorneys and other lawyers around the state who spent a year or two at the Institute. They were some of the brightest and best that came out of the law schools. Coates always favored Harvard University. He seldom looked at the grade point average of his Harvard graduates like he did those who came from other schools. The Institute in the 1950s really began to excel, not only in its legislative services, but in developing some of the early programs on urban planning and development that helped shape the way North Carolina looks today.
The great success, and we've talked about some of the idiosyncrasies of Albert Coates, but the great success and gift to North Carolina is what was the professionalization of the local government and a large degree of the state government core, something we don't, we tend to focus on the scandals and the failures of local government, but by and large, we've been blessed in North Carolina with a lot of very good professionals who have assisted in the management of local government.
And that's what sets today's school of government and the early Institute of Government apart from the other similar programs that began to crop up at other institutions. The Institute of Government was principally a training program. There was some theoretical work going on, but Albert's philosophy, and it was continued by John Sanders and other directors of the Institute, was to be a service agency in state government, and that continued up to this day. But the School of Government at Harvard and the School of Government in Georgia and other places would be more theoretical than practical. And Albert, first and foremost, was dedicated
hands-on
to
service,
practical service to local government.
Always a tension comes in the university's mission in serving the state and being a basis of sort of theoretical progress. It's maybe a subject for another program. Howard, we just got a minute or two, but one of the other poignant parts of your book was your description of the time when it became time for the university to tell Howard Coates that it was time to retire. Now, that didn't go too smoothly, did it?
Bill Aycock was the chancellor at that time, and he kept getting up, trying to get Albert to recommend a successor, and Albert never would come up with a name because he didn't want to leave. And finally, Acock said, "Well, I'm going to pick someone, and I'm going to meet me at my office on this Saturday." And they had even put off his retirement party because Albert would delay things so far as so long. And finally, Acock said, "I've got, you know, he had to do something." So he met with Albert and never could get a name out of him. And the next day, he named John Sanders as Coates' successor. And when Coates got the news, there was a dead silence on the phone, and then he said, "Oh, what a magnificent risk!"
Well, it was a great story, and everything worked out so well. John Sanders took over and did a fantastic job of managing that. But it reminded me of what you'd prepared me for, and that was that in Albert's mind, this was his.
It couldn't continue it without
his,
him.
Yeah, it was his. A great story, Howard Covington, about a great man, about Albert Coates, and an extraordinarily well-put-together book that is not just a lesson in the life of Albert Coates, but a lesson in the way that heroes have to get things done. So, Howard, thanks for sharing it with us.
Thank you, D.G.
Look forward to seeing you on November the 11th at the School of Government, where you'll be talking in the evening at
November
5 o'clock.
8.
November 8th.
Right.
I'm sorry, November 8th, School of Government Building.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks, Howard Covington. Thanks to all y'all for listening. This has been Who's Talking with D.G. Martin.